Just a quick reminder that this podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and some salty language. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, here's a much better way to see George and Gracie. Underwater. What you're hearing is recorded whale song. It is sung by the male. He'll sing anywhere from 6 to as long as 30 minutes and then start again. In the ocean, the other whales will pick up the song and pass it on. The songs change every year, and we still don't know what purpose they serve. Are they some kind of navigational signal? Could they be part of the mating ritual? Or is it pure communication beyond our comprehension? Frankly, we just don't know yet.
Maybe he's singing to that man.
Swimming.
Let him get in there.
What the hell? Oh, excuse me, wait right here. Excuse me, please. Who the hell are you? What were you doing in there?
Yeah, speak up, Tom.
Attempting the hell to communicate.
Communicate? Communicate what? You have no right to be here.
You heard the lady.
Admiral, if we were to assume that these whales are ours to do with as we please, we would be as guilty as those who caused their extinction.
Okay. I don't know what this is all about, but I want you guys out of here right now, or I call the cops.
I assure you that won't be necessary. We're only trying to help.
The hell you were, Buster. Your friend was messing up my tanks and messing up my whales.
They like you very much, but they are not the hell your whales.
I suppose they've told you that, huh?
The hell they did.
Welcome to another episode of Hanukkah Cast. Tonight, I'm recording a very special bonus tribute episode to the loss of Leonard Nimoy. Hanukkah Cast here, never question it ever, although I almost wanted to question the loss of Nimoy. I thought that it was an internet hoax, even though I kind of knew that, you know, what we were reading on the interweb, that he was suffering from chest pains, and he was in and out of the hospital for the past few years, and his health was failing. It sucks and blows at the same time. I grew up watching the Star Trek movies. I have to be honest, folks, I did not watch many episodes of the original Star Trek, but I didn't watch much of The Next Generation either. I wasn't too much of a fan of the TV series or any of the incarnations. The movies, in regards to the original cast, in no particular order, the first one I've never seen, I have to admit, and if I have seen it, I must have fallen asleep during, because I don't remember it. The second one's probably the best. The third one people have a mixed feeling for, but I'm okay with it. 4, which is the one I'm going to be discussing tonight, this is my favorite. 5 is a guilty pleasure, and 6 is also what goes out on top. And then if you go over the Next Generation, I like the 8th one, and then that's pretty much it for me for the Star Trek movies. But as for Leonard Nimoy, I mean, he had starred in other things, and of course did other things besides Star Trek, but he's most noted for Spock, and I figured, you know, why not just talk about my favorite Star Trek movie / sequel that not only wasn't so much a Spock movie, but Leonard did direct this one, so I figured it just made sense to, you know, I guess when William Shatner passes away, it'll give me an excuse to discuss Star Trek 5, because I got a lot to say about that one. But that's another podcast for another time. Now, I have to be honest with you folks, because I found out about Nimoy's death, I did not watch Star Trek 4 today, and only because, and there's no disrespect to Nimoy or his estate, or it's just that I've watched this movie so many times, I just wasn't I don't know why I should out of respect for Nimoy, but I just wasn't in the mood to watch it today. And I pretty much, from memory, know what I do and don't want to talk about. And I don't know how long the podcast is going to be tonight, but it's just out of respect, I figured I'll just talk about it for a little. And then I'm also going to discuss a little bit of a Futurama episode called Where No Fan Has Gone Before, because Leonard Nimoy, of course, voiced not only on that episode, but he also voiced on the pilot of Futurama, and he also guested on an episode of The Simpsons on the monorail episode. But I'm not going to be viewing that. Rachel and I already discussed Season 4 Simpsons of the Monorail episode. You could look for that episode. I don't have it on my hard drive anymore due to a computer virus, but I believe if anybody has ever downloaded that episode of Simpsonize Me Season 4, you should be able to find the podcast where Rachel and I did, you know, discuss that. But let's move on to Star Trek 4. I heard about this movie. I don't remember exactly where I was when it was being discussed. All I remember, I think I was online to see Howard the Duck. It is 1986. It would make sense. I think Howard the Duck was around this time. So, yeah, somebody online was telling me about the newest Star Trek movie, about a probe destroying Earth looking for whales, and they have to go back in time to rescue humpback whales. Now, a couple years later, I went to Massachusetts and I got to see real-life humpback whales, which was awesome. Took pictures. I wish I still had them, but those were, you know, not digital pictures back then. Those were, you know, regular photographs. But I'm sure I'll find them one day and post them on the Facebook page. Anyway, did get to see the movie. Loved it. And it's probably, this is when video stores only had one copy of a film. This is the most requested Star Trek film ever, and probably the most talked about. Not only because Nimoy directed it, but it felt like an old-school Star Trek episode with time travel and not taking itself way too seriously and still having some preachiness to it. It just didn't feel so pretend. I mean, not that, again, I can't really discuss the first movie yet because I have, I don't know, it's not PTSD so much, but I can't seem to recall watching Star Trek the motion picture or just being bored, but I probably have to sit down and watch that one again. Sober, I suppose. But 2, of course, was kind of a sequel to, Star Trek 2 was a sequel, of course, but it was also kind of a sequel to, you know, Khan, you know. And 3, of course, they had a search for Spock, because, you know, fictional characters don't die, they just die for a while and come back, you know, later on. But this one felt like an old school, so let's go really quick into the plot. Now, I did put a disclaimer, but I just want to warn people that I am using the plot summary 50% from Wikipedia and 50% from memory, only because, as I said, I did not watch the movie today to take notes. I'm pretty much going to go to when I last saw the movie a couple years ago. So the plot deals with the events taking place after Star Trek III, where Kirk and crew are, of course, on trial because Kirk, of course, I believe, disobeyed an order. He not only, you know, they launched Spock into space after he died from saving the Enterprise from Khan, but Kirk did kill a Klingon. They did hijack their the Klingon ship called the Bird of Prey, and Kirk did destroy the USS Enterprise, which is the first time I think the USS Enterprise was blown up. It will get destroyed in many other Star Trek films, I believe. I do know that it was going to be destroyed in 8, First Contact. But the point is, now that Kirk is on trial and Spock, of course, has been resurrected from the dead, Spock is trying to remember everything that he had forgotten after he died and was brought back to life by the Genesis Project. Anyway, while this is going on and bringing, you know, the audience up to speed, there is a probe from another planet. It's this long cylinder-esque probe that it's just floating through space, and then when it gets to Earth, through this gravitational pull, there is this orb, and it gives off probably the creepiest sound I've ever heard in 80s sci-fi. It's hypnotic and scary at the same time, but it's a great sound from any 80s movie I've ever heard. It's literally tearing apart Earth looking for something. So Kirk and crew, you know, they want to go back to Earth because I think they're on a shore leave or something. And as they're heading back to Earth, they get a signal from Starfleet Command saying that, you know, do not come back to Earth because there is a probe that's destroying Earth looking for something. So Kirk and crew are able to decipher what the probe was looking for, and apparently the probe was looking for humpback whales, because many years ago, I guess these aliens heard of humpback whales, and they like to communicate with humpback whales, but now it's the year 2288, and humpback whales have been killed off by whalers, so the planet doesn't realize it. They sent the probe, and the probe is destroying Earth trying to find these whales. And there's one of two options. They could either tell the probe that the whales aren't there, or they have a better idea. They decide to travel back in time. Now, time travel in 80s movies were nothing new. Here, they do like this slingshot maneuver literally around the sun. And we'll get to that. And they go back to the year 1986, which is now. They go to San Francisco, and they use the Bird of Prey's cloaking device because, you know, Klingon ships were known for having the cloaking devices. And Kirk, of course, breaks up everyone into teams. Kirk and Spock are going to try to locate humpback whales in the 20th century, while you have Scotty, McCoy, and Sulu. They have to prepare a tank and somehow put it in the Bird of Prey so, you know, they can bring the whales back. And, of course, Uhura and Chekhov are tasked to find a nuclear reactor so they can get some nuclear energy to power, you know, the Bird of Prey ship. So while this is going on, we got some great moments. Kirk and Spock find the whales can be at this museum in San Francisco. But unfortunately, these whales have been saved by whalers, but they're going to be sent back out into the ocean. As Kirk and Spock go on a tour, Spock jumps into the whale tank, and he does his famous Vulcan mind meld. And he finds out that the whales will be willing to go back with the crew of the Enterprise into the future. And it also turns out that these whales are male and female. George and Gracie. Get it? You know, George Burns and Gracie. And it turns out that Gracie's pregnant. While this is going on, you have a marine biologist that you probably remember this actor's name. She was in Seventh Heaven. And, of course, she was in Child's Play as the mom. It is none other than, yep, you've guessed it, Catherine Hicks. And she's Dr. Jillian Taylor, a marine biologist. And I kind of, you know, I guess it would be 2 years before Child's Play and a few years before Seventh Heaven. But, you know, she's okay in this. Anyway, Scotty, McCoy, they're able to go to a scientist, give the formula about creating transparent aluminum. They're willing to give the formula so this way they can get the materials needed for the whaling tank, and we'll get into it. As for Uhura and Chekhov, they do find the aircraft carrier Enterprise, get it? And they're trying to collect the power that they need, you know, to power the ship, of course. And for some reason, while they're on the aircraft carrier, of course they're discovered, Uhura is beamed back to the ship, but Chekhov, for some reason, is not. He gets captured, and there's this great interrogation scene, which is kind of like a vaudevillian act. And when Chekhov tries to use one of his, Enterprise laser beams to stun his interrogators. It does not work because of the radiation, so he tries to escape, and when he escapes, he gets severely injured. And he ends up at a hospital. McCoy and Kirk and Spock find out. They go and dress as doctors, and they're able to rescue Chekhov. So that's pretty much it. It all ends up with the whales being sent out a few days earlier out to the ocean. Eventually, Catherine Hicks' character realizes that Spock and Kirk are from the future, and I will get into all that in a few minutes. But they end up taking the bird of prey. They end up going out to the ocean. They find the whales. Whale is about to kill the whales, but thankfully the bird of prey comes in. It's cloaked. Beams the whales aboard. They go back to the future, and they're able to deposit the whales into the San Francisco Bay, I guess, of the 23rd century. We are 2286. So the humpback whales are now in the future. They sing to the probe. The probe goes away, and Kirk is on trial again. As I said, he was on trial for, for God knows what. I mean, he was also going to be an admiral, but because he's disobeyed Starfleet command, he blew up the Enterprise, he captured a Klingon, but, watch Star Trek 3, you know what Kirk did. He's demoted to being a captain again, and as for the good doctor, Catherine Hicks, Gillian Taylor decided to go to the future with Kirk, and she joins Enterprise, but they're going to be on two separate ships now, I guess, because, I guess she's kind of like a Bond girl, or whatever the case may be. So, Enterprise goes on the next mission, Earth is saved, the end. Okay, so, let me go into the movie a little bit. First and foremost, the first 20 minutes are amazing, like any Star Trek episode or Star Trek movie should be, original episode, original. The actors I know did not like each other too much from the stories that I've heard, but they do play off of each other very well. I'll give them that. Second thing is, I do love the moment, because this is technically Spock's movie, again, because he directed it, but what I really enjoyed was when the resurrected Spock is in this room and he has to go through a series of tests, and there's this computer that's asking him all these questions, and he has to answer questions and type questions all at the same time. He has to multitask, pretty much. Like, a computer will be asking him questions, but while a computer's asking him questions, there's another computer that's writing them, so he has to answer and type two different answers, or maybe three or four, all at the same time. It's a great scene. I'm trying to find the audio clip for it, but I can't seem to for some reason. Then, of course, you have the trial scene about everything that happened with Star Trek 3 with, Kirk hijacking the Bird of Prey, Kirk taking things personally. Again, I'm not going to get into Star Trek 3 too much, because I have not watched Star Trek 3 in years. I have not seen Star Trek 3 in about probably 5-6 years, so I don't remember too much about it. So I'm just going to move on from Star Trek 3. Anyway, I do enjoy the trial scene, because you have a great plethora of these alien creatures that, dare I say, a Trump's leftover of, the Cantina scene or Jabba's Palace from Return of the Jedi in Star Wars. But the probe I want to get into, as I said, it's a really creepy special effect, and it's a really creepy noise that it makes. I'm trying to find the audio clip for it as well. But it's for 80 special effects. I thought it was amazing, the way that it just comes from outer space, it's just floating through, that sphere drops, and it just starts literally draining the oceans, or it's tearing apart the oceans looking for the whales. It's just, and even when Kirk and company are trying to get back to Earth, and you have, like, Starfleet Command from Earth telling people to not come to Earth. Like, it's been the entire planet's been blocked off because this probe is, you know, tearing apart oceans left and right. For 80s, it couldn't get any better, special effect-wise. For me, anyway. I mean, I'm not as nitpicky as you think. But then we have time travel. And time travel, for me, in movies, I mean, you either had the DeLorean, or I guess you had, like, this gigantic machine you would step into and type in coordinates. But for me, I'm always going to remember the DeLorean. This one, apparently, you somehow slingshot your way around the sun itself. You don't get too close, you don't get too far. And while all this is going on, the crew is kind of like in the suspended animation. It's really the most bizarre thing I ever saw. They do it again, of course, and I guess they recycle the footage. But, of course, you know, I guess to go to the past, you have to go to the left side, and to the future, you have to go to the right side, you know. But it is the most bizarre thing. But the scenes that I really enjoy, too, is while they're in San Francisco. Because Spock is a Vulcan, he has to take this bandana and put it around his ears to cover his pointy ears, which is, you know, people in the theater to this day, I recall they were laughing hysterically. And, of course, because they're in the 20th century and they're walking around in their garb, which is what I love, the best moment is when Kirk and Spock go on a bus, and they're kicked off the bus, and Spock turns to Kirk and goes, "What is exact change?" Again, great reaction. People were howling in the theater. And then, of course, when they finally do get on the bus, there's a punk that's playing a song, and Kirk tells the guy to lower the volume on the boombox, and the punk won't, so Spock does the Vulcan neck pinch, and, you know, people on the bus are applauding. Again, people in the theater are howling. So, there were a lot of great Spock moments. And, of course, let's not forget Spock in the whale tank. People loved how Spock didn't know what the word hell meant, so he just thought, like, the hell, they're not your whales, the hell they told me. So, but then all the other scenes. I mean, Scotty telling the scientists about, you know, the transparent aluminum, and trying to communicate with the computer, and picking up the mouse, and, like, he can talk into the mouse like it was, you know, it's a speaker. Classic. And, of course, let's not forget Chekhov, where, you know, during the nuclear vessel scene, or him being interrogated, McCoy has some great moments as well. You know, especially when they're in the hospital rescuing Chekhov from being operated on. All in all, it's probably one of the smartest light on a feather Star Trek movies that I can think of. Now, originally, for Season 3 of Hunnic Outcast, I was going to dedicate the entire season to the 80s, and this was going to be my season finale, but because of Nimoy's passing, I decided to I can't think of a better... I mean, as much as I'd like to do The Search of Spock or Wrath of Khan, again, Nimoy directed this movie. This is Nimoy's baby, and the social commentary pretty much, you know, there is preachiness in a way, but it's not crammed down our throat, with the whales being extinct. And thankfully, humpback whales have not been wiped off the face of the earth. In a world right now where people are so worried about pollution and World War III, I like the fact that this is a movie that was concerned about one species of animal, and I just love the performances, and again, how everybody played off well with each other, and direction by Nimoy, and the line reads. This movie gets a solid 5 out of 5, and I'm just going to go through some quick trivia here. Again, most of this, unfortunately, last minute, just going to get this off of Wikipedia. This is technically a story arc between Wrath of Khan and Search for Spock. I didn't really take it as that. I thought the arc was Khan and Spock. I didn't think this was part of that arc, but apparently it is. Apparently, okay, Nimoy did direct Search for Spock. You know what? I apologize, folks. This is why I have not seen Search for Spock in years. I did not realize... I forgot, I should say. I forgot that he directed Search for Spock. Shoot. But I guess this one's more popular. Okay. But he got more... He was given greater freedom, so I guess that's why this one's more popular. Anyway, this had an environmental message, and no clear-cut villain, which was smarter. Not that I have anything against Christopher Lloyd and John Larroquette as Klingons in the last movie, but this one, yeah. Let's see, we also had the Wrath of Khan writer, Nicholas Meyer. Okay, different parts of the script. And, of course, approval had to be from Nimoy, William Shatner. Well, you know, why am I not surprised? Let's see. And, of course, this movie was pretty much shot extensively on location in San Francisco, which I'm not too surprised. A few of the humpback whales in the film were real. ILM devised full-size animatronics and small motorized models to stand in for the real creatures. Okay. I didn't even know. Well, good for ILM, then. Let's see. I guess this was a November movie. I do remember seeing this during Thanksgiving weekend. November 26th, and the budget for this movie was, in fact, $21 million, and it made $133 back then for 1986 dollars, so that's not too bad. And, let's see, the film earned several awards, and 4 Academy Award nominations for cinematography and audio. It was dedicated to the crew of Space Shuttle Challenger, which broke up 73 seconds after takeoff, which I do remember that, of course. Yes, this was the year that Challenger was, yeah, I do remember that. And then, of course, it would be a few years later, 3 years until we got Star Trek V, bum bum bum. I'm going to take a short break, and then I'll wrap up the show right after this.
I have the distance and bearing which were provided by Commander Uhura. If we juxtapose our coordinates, we should be able to find our destination, which lies at 283.7 degrees.
I think we'll find what we're looking for at the Station Institute in Sausalito. A pair of humpback whales named George and Gracie.
How do you know this?
Simple logic.
What does it mean, exact change?
Hello, geeks. Want a podcast that covers a vast array of topics with no rhyme or reason? Then check out Altered Geek Unlimited, where the topics fly more or less off the cuff. We cover media news, TV, our favorite geek products, and of course, your feedback. So get altered, get geeky with the Altered Geeks every Friday on the Geekcast Radio Network.
So, again... Thank you all for listening to this unscripted, unedited version. Bonus... Leonard Nimoy tribute. If you'd like to leave feedback for the show, feel free to at HanukFeedback@gmail.com, or you can find us on Facebook.com, Hanuk Outcasts. We also have a group page, Hanuk Outcasts. You can find us at Stitcher, Spreaker, TuneIn, iTunes, all one word, Hanuk Outcast. Wyatt will be back soonish, I hope. I've been communicating with him. I know we've been busy and schedules, and Season 2 technically has begun. It began, you know, with my Valentine's Day episode, my Friday the 13th. But we will have Great Dictator out for you, as well as many other episodes that I have planned. In a few days starts the first annual March Madness, and that will be scripted. Do not worry. That is scripted. I am working very hard on March Madness. Dane Lamont will join me next week for the first episode for Hanuk March Madness, as we'll be diving into, well, where else but Gotham City, because I am Batman's obsession, as Dane and I will be discussing Batman Under the Red Hood, the graphic novel in Batman Under the Red Hood, the DCAU. And as an extra added bonus, I'll be giving my thoughts again on the Gotham TV show episode of the Red Hood. Now, I already did my written review. You could find it over at geekcastradio.com in the written review section under comics and TV shows. So please check that out as well. And I just want to leave this podcast on a final thought from Leonard Nimoy, who tweeted probably the most heartbreaking tweet I've ever read at the real Nimoy. A life is like a garden. Perfect moments can be had, but not preserved, except in memory. Long live and prosper. Leonard, thank you for everything, for all your work, and thank you for listening to the show, and long live and prosper.
Yes, under U.S. government. Now we need directions. Excuse me, sir. Can you direct me to the naval base in Alameda? It's where they keep the nuclear vessels. Nuclear vessels.